Hey, it's Francis. Thank you so much for making the Splendid Table part of your life all year long. This public media podcast is only possible because of you. You generously welcome us into your kitchens, and we do our best to provide support and inspiration along the way. So please, donate before Memorial Day weekend to support our show. Go to splendidtable.org/donate, and thank you. Hey, it's Francis, and I have a problem. The amount of caffeine my body likes in a day is exactly 1 12-ounce cup of coffee. But after making this episode last year, like, all I want to do all day is sip on pot after pot of tea after I have that coffee. So I hope you don't suffer the same fate as I do. Take a listen. I'm Francis Lamb, and you're listening to The Splendid Table from APM. Hey, so put down your coffee, because I don't want you to spit it out. But did you know that around the world, people drink 3 times more tea than coffee? Tea is by far the most consumed drink in the world, next only to water. And yet, it feels like so many of us know so little about it. Okay, so to be fair, here in the US, we are much more a coffee country. Something like 60% of American adults drink coffee, compared to only 25% who drink tea. But around the world, and especially in Asia, tea rules, and it pretty much always has. Human beings' love of tea has led to wars of conquest and all kinds of barbaries over it. But we've also created immensely rich cultures of how to enjoy it, rituals for preparing and sharing it, ceremonies and devotionals around it. And so today, we're going to scratch the surface of a couple of the great tea traditions of the world. Later on in the show, we're going to learn about the fascinating history and a fantastic way to make masala chai, India's revolutionary entry to the tea canon. And we're going to start at a little tea tasting room, squirreled away down an unassuming hallway in Nolita, Manhattan. It's a tranquil little space called Tea Shop, and its proprietress, Teresa Wong, sat me down to give us the full 101 of the major styles of Chinese and Taiwanese tea and how to enjoy them. So Teresa, when we were talking yesterday, I love how you told me that you grew up in Hong Kong, you know, which was a British colony when we were kids, and that you actually, you weren't from a family of tea drinkers, and the only way you really drank tea was sort of in that British Hong Kong style, which is with milk, black tea with milk, or, you know, with lemon and honey. But here, we're actually doing something very different. This is very sort of traditional, typical Chinese-style tea, no milk, no honey, and it's just different kinds of tea steeped in water. So I've heard that there are 3,000 varieties of tea. So how do you break it down?
So teas are broken down in majorly 6 categories.
Okay.
Green tea, white tea, yellow tea, oolong tea, black tea, and pu'er tea. Those are major categories in Chinese tea. Tea is all from the same plant, Camellia sinensis. What makes them different is mostly because of their processing. So mostly determined by their oxidation level to determine this is a green tea, white tea, oolong tea, or black tea.
Okay.
That's how it goes. Yeah.
So it's not like in wine, it's different grapes, and in, you know, coffee, it's more about the different origins. It's about the processing, how they've actually been harvested and processed.
Yeah, there are obviously many different varietals. So yeah. People would use particular varietal for a particular style.
Okay.
But it doesn't mean that this varietal cannot be used for the other. So today we actually have an example that we have a Korean varietal that usually people use for green tea. Mm. But we request the farmer to use the same season tea to fully oxidize to make into black tea as well. So we have one tea that is from one farmer, same season, same varietal,
okay.
But one is green tea, one is black tea, because they are different processing.
Oh, cool. And so we'll be able to taste the difference purely in the processing then.
Yes.
Cool. And actually, before we get into tasting, how does a tea go from white tea to green to yellow to oolong to black to pu'er, if I got that right? Physically, how is a tea sort of treated to create that oxidation?
So when I talk about oxidation, I always compare it to apple. It's like after you cut apple open, it starts turning brown color from the edges. Mm-hmm. That's when the oxidation starts taking place. And the longer you expose to the air, is turning more brown color. Same thing with the tea leaves. So with green tea, that is one tea without oxidation. It's after it's being baked, people send to pan drying or steaming. Okay. Use high temperature to stop the tea from going to oxidation.
Okay, okay.
That's why the tea has very green color. Versus when we go to oxidation, it's after picking, they put on a tray and then on a rack of many trays together. Depends on the weather and humidity, it could take 10 to 20 hours or even more than, even like up to a day mm-hmm. to sitting there. The processing is to let the tea soften a little bit.
Mm.
And then it would go to indoor oxidation, which they would have a very warmer room. Okay. And then put the tea on the floor and then just let it sit there until it start turning color, turning more brown. Farmer will come in to check to see like how's the oxidation, to flip the tea over mm-hmm. so they would be more evenly.
Sure.
And then it would, when he decided to stop oxidation, then it would go to shaping the leaves and also drying, and then you would go to finish the tea. So the oxidation, how long it takes, determine the tea is oolong tea or black tea.
Yeah.
And for white tea is a little bit different. Is it doesn't go into the intentionally oxidation process.
Okay.
It just pick and dry, so naturally dry. But while it's waiting for naturally dry, it might take some time. So oxidation happens very mildly. Oxidation happens while we're waiting for drying.
Okay. And the difference between that and the green tea is heat treated to stop the oxidation, mm-hmm. so it does prevents any oxidation.
Prevent oxidation.
That's out. Like if you cook an apple, like you said.
Yes.
The apple doesn't turn brown mm-hmm. after you cooked it. Yeah.
Yeah, and for pu'er tea is very interesting. There are two major categories of pu'er tea.
Okay.
It could be the raw pu'er tea, which was almost like a green tea of pu'er, but over time as it age, it becomes darker.
Okay.
So it's like naturally oxidation throughout time, maybe 10, 20 years.
Yeah, okay. So this is not a couple hours. This is
not a couple hours. Or we call a kupur, show pu'er, that is go through a fermentation process that makes the tea darker to begin with, and instead of waiting 10, 20 years for it to get dark.
Mm, okay.
Yeah.
So now that we have the varieties,
mm-hmm.
should we do some tasting?
Yes.
See what they're how they differ?
So I always tell customer, I know when people come in the shop, they got very excited, especially when they see all those like small teaware, teacups. It's super cute, and they want to buy everything. I was like, no, the first thing you should get is good tea first.
Okay.
And then start drinking good tea in your own way. And then when you develop more interest, over time you build up your collection of teawares. Yeah. That's how it works. Yeah. So very, very important is start with good tea, because even good tea, you don't brew it like Kung Fu style, just very casually drinking it, you can still tell the quality. And a lot of our tea, when we work with our farmer, actually we specific looking for tea that is very friendly to brew. So that means no matter how you brew it, it always, you can enjoy it.
Okay,
so today I actually prepare one green tea and the black tea with the same farmer, same season that we were talking
so
about.
So it's literally the same tea from the same place, from the same time. Just one is green and one is black.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then one white tea
and
two oolong tea. To brew in a mug, just put the tea leaves in at hot water.
Okay.
Yep.
So the first question I have always is, how much tea do you use and how much water?
Yeah, that's actually a very good question. I compare tea to cooking a lot.
Oh, okay.
When you ask your grandma like how a recipe, she's like a little bit of salt,
Yeah, just put in enough.
Yes. The tea is the same way. So actually, I thought about that and I actually do my own measurement early this morning just to give an estimate.
Okay, great, great.
So you can see the tea has different shapes, the tea leaves.
Sure.
One that looks very different is a rolled into a ball shape. Mm-hmm. This is a most likely a Taiwanese oolong style that they rolled into ball shape.
Yeah.
With that tea, I would say do around 1 teaspoon
Okay.
And then the other tea, like loose leaf.
The loose leaf. They're long, they're hard to fit in a teaspoon.
Yeah, I would say 1 tablespoon.
Okay.
So when I do the exact measurement, it's around 3 grams of the tea.
Okay.
And then we put in the mud.
And how much water?
Just fill it like, this is probably 6 ounces.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so we're brewing this tea in sort of a typical steep fashion, right? You're going to put tea leaves in the mug, you're going to put hot water in it. After a few minutes, we pour it out and we drink it. But you've talked about Kung Fu style. What is Kung Fu style? It's a different method of preparing the tea.
Yes. Kung Fu style is more tea leaves, less water. So we get a more intense taste of tea.
Yeah.
And we put in effort to brew the tea, a little bit more effort, a little bit more skill.
Yeah.
We usually start with smaller vessel. The one I'm using today is a Gaiwan. And this one is, I think, is under 3 ounces.
Mm-hmm.
And with this Gaiwan, I will put around 5 to 7 grams of tea.
Okay.
And then I will dip each infusions around 15 to 30 seconds.
Super fast.
Super fast.
Yeah.
But this way, I'm actually able to re-steep the tea multiple more times.
Yeah.
And what I really love about it is each infusion is always a fresh, hot cup of tea.
Yeah. And everyone tastes different, right? I think that's kind of like the idea. There's so much tea in there, like so many tea leaves, and such a short steep that the way it was sort of described to me, I think it's so interesting. It's almost like each infusion like takes another layer of flavor out of the tea. So you can taste the different layers of flavor as it changes.
Yes. Also, the smell changes too.
Mm.
The first time when I tried tea this way, like Kung Fu style, I was so blown away. Like every cup is so different. And I'm still drinking the same tea, but every cup is just different. And I start doing it at home. And what makes me keep doing it every day is I really love the process.
Mm.
It's very calming. It's almost like meditation. Sometimes people would describe it like meditation in movement.
Mm.
You know, when we do Tai Chi, it's like we're moving very slowly. So it's every movement, we are very mindful of that. And that's almost like meditation. And brewing tea is the same way too.
So right now, you're putting the tea leaves just into these beautiful little mugs.
Mm-hmm. I usually would say, except for green tea, most tea you can use boiling water, which is 212 Fahrenheit.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Green tea is usually a little bit more delicate, so I would say around 185 to 190 Fahrenheit.
Okay.
Yes.
So that's like you boil the water and you let it sit for like a minute or two before you use it. Okay.
Yeah, I never really use a thermometer either. And just add water.
Okay. I love the sight of this. I love to use these clear mugs because it's so beautiful when the tea, when the water hits the tea and it just starts to make the tea leaves dance.
Yes.
I love that. We'll be back with more of Teresa Wong of Tea Shop and her teas. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. Our show is supported by Hero Bread. You know, for a lot of us, bread has been a staple all our lives. Toast at breakfast, sandwiches at lunch, a nice buttered roll at dinner. It's comforting and delicious, and bread is often what we crave. But sometimes, it can sit a little heavy after a meal. That's where Hero Bread comes in. They've created fluffy, delicious versions of the breads that we're used to, but that include no net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, and fewer calories. Oh, and there's more good stuff too, like protein and fiber. Hero Bread has everything from your daily sandwich loaf to tortillas or hot dog and hamburger buns. The products are flavorful, and they have something for every craving, from a dressed-up breakfast burrito to a late-night PB&J. They even have monthly small-batch drops of indulgent treats like 2-gram net-carb Hero Croissant or the 1-gram net-carb Hero Cheddar Biscuit. Don't give up being a breadhead. Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code TABLE at checkout. That's table at hero.co.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters. We're learning about how to fall in love with East Asian tea with authority Teresa Wong of the Tea Shop New York. So brew yourself a cup. Let's get back to it with her. We're just about to start tasting. Thank you.
Yeah.
So this is the green tea.
Yes. So this is a Korean green tea. Mm-hmm. Chinese and Korean green tea, they have the same style, which most of them, they are using pan drying.
Okay.
So the flavor is slightly nuttier.
Yeah.
A little bit like green peas.
Totally.
Versus the Japanese green tea is used steaming to stop the oxidation. So it's a little bit more umami, seaweed taste.
Like matcha, when people have matcha. Like that's,
yes.
That's why there's that sort of, it's a very different flavor.
Yeah, it's very different. So this is a Korean green tea. It's more similar. You taste a little bit like chestnut to me. It's like nutty, but very powdery, very soft kind.
Yeah, it definitely tastes a little bit toasty, like you said.
Yeah.
Almost like a grain, like mm-hmm. barley or something like that. Very light, very...
Slightly nice. Sweet at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Not bitter.
Not bitter.
Yeah.
And a little bit astringent. Like you can feel your tongue like sort of like... A little bit dry, a little bit tightened up, but mm-hmm. like in a pleasant way.
Yes. So a lot of people were very afraid of bitter or astringent in tea, but it's actually very normal mm-hmm. because tea has tannin in it, just like wine.
Mm-hmm.
So you should be able to differentiate a good bitter and a bad bitter.
Sure.
So a good tea is you notice the bitter or you notice the astringency, but it has a lot more going on besides mm-hmm, the bitter mm-hmm. astringency. And it's very pleasant. Even though you notice that, it doesn't really bother you.
Yeah, it doesn't make your face go like... Rrr.
Yes, yes. And a bad one is usually due to poor quality or poor processing is something that you taste just very flat bitterness and it doesn't have other sweetness that go along with it. Mm. And those we try to avoid that.
Yeah.
It would be interesting to try the black tea.
Okay.
After, so you will see how the oxidation makes the tea different.
So this is the same, again, same tea. This is just black versus green.
Yes.
The way it's treated. Okay. Mm. Like right away, you can smell it's very different.
Yeah. It's a little bit more floral.
Totally. More
you
complex.
Smell a lot more sweetness.
Oh, I love that. It's a lot deeper,
mm-hmm.
like the flavor.
Yeah, and more complex.
Yeah.
The green tea is more delicate. Like mm-hmm. you taste a lot more freshness. It's just sweeter, deeper.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's what oxidation do to tea. It changes the taste profile. The roasting and the oxidation create layers in the tea that brings out more body and nuances in the tea. So a good tea farmer or tea maker, they know what to do to bring out the best of the tea.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we're gonna taste a white tea.
Okay. Okay, I just tasted the white tea. I always thought white tea, white is white and green is green. So like white would be lighter than green, but that's not the case at all.
Yeah, a lot of people would be like, I don't like white tea. It doesn't taste like anything.
Maybe it's just the quality of this tea, but this tastes like vanilla. It tastes so much like vanilla.
Sweet.
Super sweet.
Slightly creamy.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's why you think of vanilla. For me, it's like soy milk.
Sometimes
it's like slightly nutty, creamy soy milk.
It has a little more bitterness.
And
it definitely has more astringency also.
Yeah. And also a little bit like rose water.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Totally, totally.
And then we have two oolong tea left.
Okay.
From what you can see, the color looks very different. Yes.
Okay, so this was a different tasting almost entirely because I remember earlier when we spoke, you said, I want you to taste two different oolongs so you see how different oolong can be. So
yeah.
Most green teas will be in the range of what we tasted for green tea.
Yes.
Most black tea is in the range of what we taste for black tea. But oolong is its own kind of beast. And yeah, looking at the two, one, the leaf itself is still quite green. It looks like, you know, collard greens that have been stewing for a little while. It's like a little bit brownish and green. But the tea is still pretty clear and slightly green. And the other looks very dark. It's actually the darkest one on the table, darker than the black tea.
Yeah, so oolong tea is anything that is semi-oxidized. So when we think about semi-oxidized, it could be 20% oxidation, 50% oxidation, or it could be 80% oxidation.
Okay.
And on top of that, it could be done with or without roasting.
Okay.
So the one that you're drinking right now, it looks very green,
mm-hmm.
which is very minimal oxidation. It's like very lightly oxidized, so it tastes still very close to...
A green tea.
This is a very typical style of Taiwanese high mountain oolong. Mm. This is actually a high mountain oolong, like slightly green color.
Yeah, yeah.
The tea
tastes
is
like green beans.
Yeah, golden color. So that's Taiwanese style high mountain oolong tea.
Popcorn and green beans.
Popcorn, yeah.
A little bit.
This tea is actually very buttery. Yeah.
Oh, nice.
And the other oolong tea we have, which is a darker one, is from Wuyi Mountain in China, Fujian, China.
Okay.
That region is particular, very famous for a oolong tea called Yan Cha, a style called Yan Cha, which is, if we translate it, it means cliff tea. So the tea grows along the cliffs.
Mm.
And traditionally, they are very heavy roasted. So this one is a Telohan. Yes, is very traditionally 3-time roasted, so you can see very dark.
Yeah, roasted 3 times.
Yeah.
Wow.
So tea can be done with or without roasting. Like the Taiwanese oolong tea we try is mm-hmm. like done without roasting.
Okay.
And this one is 3-time roasting.
Okay.
If you're growing up like around Wuyi Mountain, or if you're growing up in South Asia, like Guangdong or Hong Kong,
mm-hmm.
My impression of oolong tea is like it should be
this
color.
Yeah, it's very bronze.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of time people have a misunderstanding of roasted tea. When they see the tea very dark color, the first initial is, I'm not going to like this because it's going to taste very bitter.
Mm. Even just the smell makes me think like, oh, I need some dim sum right now.
Yes. Dim sum is from South China.
Yeah, this is the iconic pairing.
Yes. So this tea, even though it's heavy roasted, it just have a deeper note, but mm-hmm. it's not bitter.
Sure.
It's a little bit woody.
Definitely woody. I was like, yeah, it smells like a forest. It smells like tree bark. It smells like...
woody, but very smooth when you drink it. And it has a nice... sweetness, but the sweetness is different from other tea too.
Yeah.
It's slightly more mineral sweetness.
Yeah.
It's because Yan Cha from that region, they grow along the cliffs because of the environment. It has a more mineral sweetness in the tea itself.
Yeah.
So, it's very unique.
Hokkam.
Mm. Hokkam, yes.
So gum is a word that I've never really been able to translate in Cantonese. At first, it was... like ginseng, my parents would say, was very gum,
mm-hmm.
and this is very gum. It's almost like there's a bitterness. So
yes.
I used to think it just meant bitter.
Bittersweet.
But it's bittersweet. Yeah, that's nice. It's like, because it's very slightly bitter, but there's mm-hmm. something else that like lifts it up.
Yeah.
And like when you said it was minerally, like it almost tastes like a little bit metallic, but in a very nice way.
Mm-hmm.
Like in the back of your tongue, it's almost like it's sparkling back
mm-hmm.
there.
So I always say a good roasted tea is like that. I always compare it to coffee since you're a coffee drinker.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people thought coffee is bitter, but coffee is not bitter. It's bitter because of the roasting.
Sure.
So when you burn the coffee bean or when there's too much roasting, it becomes bitter. When you burn something when you're cooking, it's bitter. And when you burn the tea, if you over roast it, it's bitter. But a good roaster should know when to stop to bring out the sweetness mm-hmm, in the tea mm-hmm, instead mm-hmm. of bitterness. So a good roasted tea should not be bitter. Yeah.
So how do you know if you're getting good tea? Like, how do you know if you're getting the good stuff?
First of all, from dry leaves, you look at the color.
Okay.
And you look at the size of the leaves, like if it's full leaf or it's like broken leaves, those also matter. And then when you brew it, the color, that's why we use a white cup.
Okay.
Because you can see the color, the clarity of the tea. Even with the glass shell, you can see that it's clear. Mm-hmm. Like, it's very clear color. When you drink it, it's not flat. Like, it has layers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Those are very basic to start with. And one thing I always tell customers is, if you really want to be assured of your tea quality, just to brew the tea stronger, using more tea leaves, hot temperature, steep it for a longer time. And usually good tea will show the character more when you brew it stronger. Like good tea, you're not afraid to brew it strong. Sometimes when I travel to sourcing for tea, the way we taste the tea is like we brew it really strong, not really to enjoy the tea, but really to...
Just like kind of analyze it.
Yes.
And vice versa, if you're making it for yourself, mm-hmm. if you want a lighter flavor, you can use fewer leaves, you can use cooler water, you can brew it for less time.
Yeah, you can adjust in many ways.
So I have to ask you this. People who are into tea, they always just say, oh, never drink tea bags, and they just like dismiss it. Mm-hmm. But why would you say you can't really have great tea in tea bags?
Over the years, I think people are trying to improve the quality of tea bag.
Okay.
When I was a kid, my tea bag impression is Lipton tea bag. So
sure.
You don't really see leaves in there.
Oh, that's a good point.
Nowadays, you see a lot more, like they will market it saying full leaves, or they're using whole leaves, pyramid tea bag. So you have rooms for the tea to expand.
Okay.
So I assume the quality has been better throughout the years.
Sure. Okay, yeah.
But I haven't tried it myself, so I cannot speak of the quality.
Yeah.
But I always I travel with tea, and sometimes like if I cannot bring the whole set with me, my easier way is I will bring some empty sachet, like the empty tea bag,
mm-hmm.
and bring some of the full leaves that I know the quality.
Yeah.
And just scoop the full leaves into the sachet and make my own tea bag immediately.
Yeah.
And that way I can still enjoy the quality. And it's just a very easy way of enjoying tea.
Oh, I love that. Well, thank you again so much. This has been super, super, super interesting and really delicious.
Thank you. Let's have tea.
Yeah.
East Asian Tea Authority Teresa Wong is the owner of the tea shop in New York City. You can buy her terrific teas at her website, teashopny.com. That's tea, just the letter T. And if you're in New York, you can visit her shop, get a cup to go, or book a guided tasting. So from the meditative purity of a Chinese tea tasting room, we're going to go now to the homes and railways and streets of India, where tea is enjoyed in a totally different way. Not simply steeped, but boiled hard with rich milk, probably sugar, and blends of anywhere from 3 to who knows how many different spices. Yes, I'm talking about chai. Masala chai, to be precise, and you really don't have to call it chai tea because chai means tea. And our guide for this journey into chai history is food and culture writer Lena Trivedi-Grenier. Hey, Lena, it's great to see you.
Hey, Francis. Thanks for having me.
I am super excited to talk about masala chai with you. And I actually want to start with your story, because you have this, your story begins with this really wonderful image of your grandmother's, you know, personal ritual for preparing masala chai. And, you know, I think when I was reading it, and probably as far as most people reading it, have this image that, you know, masala chai has been something that Indian people have been, you know, enjoying every day for centuries. But then there's this really striking line in your story, because you say, she didn't grow up drinking it because it was invented in her lifetime. So, you know, just a couple of generations ago. So let's start with that. What is the history of masala chai?
It really starts off with the British colonizing India.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a great obsession for Chinese tea. And the Chinese basically blocked them. And they, you know, it's not a pretty history for the Indian people. The British basically stole land from Indians where they saw tea growing wildly.
Mm-hmm.
Then they kind of tricked lower class Indians into indentured servitude to grow the tea.
Mm.
And then once they had all this tea, they didn't have enough consumers for it. And so they needed to find a way to make Indians drink tea. My grandmother, we called her Modi Ben. Her name means big sister in Gujarati. She was born in 1922. And in 1922, masala chai was not a tradition. And it really didn't get created until sometime between 1918 and 1930. And it didn't make its way to Modi Ben's home in Shukla Tirth, Gujarat, until the 1940s. Wow. And so, it's a relatively new invention, which is, it surprises a lot of people.
Yeah. And what is the story of that creation?
Well, so what happened is there was a group created called the Indian Tea Association. And it was owned by a lot of the big British owners of the tea estates, the big tea estates in India. Okay. And they basically got together and were like, we need to make Indians buy our tea. How do we do this? And so they created a 40-plus year campaign to basically indoctrinate Indians into drinking this tea, the British way, of course, with milk and sugar. Okay. And so this means that they went to upper-class homes and gave proper tea demonstrations on how to have a tea service. They gave away tea at public gatherings, at religious festivals, and they set up tea stalls at everywhere from railroad stations, street-side stations, and they even convinced the government to give industrial workers a tea break every day. And they had tea stalls set up outside for them. And of course, they were religiously separated, one for the Muslims and one for the Hindus. And so we see even in that early time period, the British were kind of encouraging the early stages of partition just through the tea. And yeah. So they did this for about 40 plus years. And by the end of the 20th century, 70% of Indians were drinking tea,
Yeah. So if tea, you know, as it was consumed in the British style, wasn't really introduced until the early 1900s. Yeah. Like, so like 80, 90 years to convert an entire country of, you know, almost a billion people at that point, right? Like, unbelievable. And then,
Yeah. And the creation of masala chai. So one of the things the Indian Tea Association did was they gave tea to railway wallahs, which is also known as like street vendors. Okay. And I want to be clear, the tea that they gave Indians was the lowest grade of tea. So it was, we're talking in the early times, it was like tea dust. And around 1930, they invented this method called CTC, which is known as crush, tear, curl. And it creates a low-grade, strong-tasting, and quick-brewing tea granules. And so they gave those to the valas, and the valas were like making it like they were told. And they're like, oh, this kind of tastes bitter. This doesn't really taste really good, right? And so
I know you wanted to drink this. It's not
I know. So they did what they've been doing for centuries, which is they added masala to it, masala meaning spice blend. Mm-hmm. And now India already had a tradition, and this was a tradition that Modi Ben grew up with, of drinking medicinal spice blends in tea. Okay, so that was, they already had a tradition.
Not tea in the way with tea leaves, but like in tea leaves.
Yes, it
spices,
was literally just spices and water boiled together for different types of medicine. Okay. And so they already had that practice. And they had a practice of adding masala to foods to make it taste better. Sure. And so the valas basically put two and two together and started making masala chai. And the first reference in history that I've really found about it was the Indian Tea Association in the 1930s. They discovered this masala chai and they got very angry. They thought that the masala was adulterating the tea.
You people are giving them the worst tea you have anyway. Like,
right, exactly. And they started going to different valas and shutting down their stands if they saw that they used the masala. They also like hired British people to sell this tea the British way, where the other valas were selling the masala chai, to try to put them out of business. Huh. And as we know, masala chai won. Masala chai is still around.
Yes.
And so when you look at it, yes. So when you look back at it, the adding of the masala was really an act of rebellion against the British. And it was really, it was like Indian saying, you're giving us crappy tea, we're going to make it taste good. And it's kind of revolutionary, right? It's something that outlived the British rule, and it turned this kind of tool of oppression into a tradition.
We'll be back with more of Masala Chai with writer Lena Trivedi Grenier. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. Our show is supported by Hero Bread. You know, for a lot of us, bread has been a staple all our lives. Toast at breakfast, sandwiches at lunch, a nice buttered roll at dinner. It's comforting and delicious, and bread is often what we crave. But sometimes, it can sit a little heavy after a meal. That's where Hero Bread comes in. They've created fluffy, delicious versions of the breads that we're used to, but that include no net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, and fewer calories. Oh, and there's more good stuff too, like protein and fiber. Hero Bread has everything from your daily sandwich loaf to tortillas or hot dog and hamburger buns. The products are flavorful and they have something for every craving, from a dressed-up breakfast burrito to a late-night PB&J. They even have monthly small-batch drops of indulgent treats like 2-gram net-carb Hero Croissant or the 1-gram net-carb Hero Cheddar Biscuit. Don't give up being a breadhead. Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code TABLE at checkout. That's table at hero.co. I'm Francis Lam, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. We're all about tea on this episode, and we're talking now about the great tea culture of India, Masala Chai, with writer Lena Trivedi Grenier. Let's get back to it with her. So tell me, like, in your family, obviously we've heard you talk about your grandmother, but, like, what's the role of Masala Chai in your family? Like, you were telling me the other day that when you visited family, you might have 4 or 5 different pots going, each with a different masala blend to suit different tastes in the family.
Right, right. I mean, Masala Chai is really an act of hospitality. Anytime I go, when I visit India, every single house I go to, they're making Masala Chai. When I go to visit my aunts and uncles, my Indian aunts and uncles in central Illinois, they're always serving Masala Chai with a little snack, right? For me, I grew up seeing my grandmother, Modi Ben. Every morning she'd get up really early and she would do her pujas, Hindu prayers. And then she would make her masala chai, and she would drink it in a little stainless steel cup with a stainless steel saucer. And it, as a kid, it kind of drove me crazy. I mean, Modi Ben, she took like 20 minutes to drink this cup of chai, and she would tip the cup into the saucer and then hold the saucer up to her mouth and blow on it and then sip it from the saucer. And I didn't really understand it back then, but now as an adult, I can see that was like her tie back to her family, back to her culture, right? And so, I mean, for me, I grew up dealing with a lot of racism, being an Indian American, a Gujarati American living in Illinois, and I kind of rejected Indian food from like junior high through high school. I mean, I had more than 10 years of racism going for me. And so I didn't want anything to do with Indian food. When I first stole a sip of Modi Ben's masala chai, that was the first time I was like, maybe there's something to this Indian food, right? But it wasn't until after my undergrad, I went to culinary school. And that was the first place I went where people were asking me, are you Indian? And I kind of held my breath and they were like, I was like, yeah. And they didn't make a joke afterwards. They were like, oh, well, do you know how to make roti? Do you know how to make papad? Do you know how to make? And I got kind of excited. I'm like, oh, so it's okay. It's kind of cool for me to be Indian again, right? And so the very first recipe I recreated was Moti Ben's chai, right? Oh, wow. I walked through the Indian grocery store. I gathered all the ingredients. I made it at home, and it was such a nostalgic feeling. And then also a little bit of grief. You know, when I was growing up with Modi Ben, she only spoke Gujarati and I only spoke English. And so we didn't really connect as much as I would have liked to looking back as an adult. And so it's it really became a tradition around that time in my like probably like early to mid 20s. And to this day, I drink it like at least 2 times a day.
Wow. You didn't as you just said, you weren't able to speak with her. Like you couldn't share an exchange in terms of your language.
Right.
And I remember reading in your story that she actually passed away before you learned to make the chai from her. And it was your father who actually had a written recipe. So how did you learn to make it? Like, why was there a written recipe?
Well, there was a written recipe because my dad was the first member of his family to move to the United States. He came in 1969 to San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And he didn't have enough money to visit home for several years. He barely had enough money to even have phone calls with the family. Mm-hmm. And so he was on his own learning how to make Gujarati food for himself. And the first time he was able to get a trip home, maybe 4 or 5 years later, he visited Modiben. And that's when he started asking her to write down some recipes. And masala chai was one of the recipes. Now, my dad is, to this day, he's not a big chai drinker, but anytime relatives come to visit throughout my childhood, he would bust out this recipe and make this chai. And so when I started, he gave me the recipe, and I originally used her recipe, and then I just tinkered with it over the years. And I mean, I think almost every time I make it, I do a little something different, but it's always the same three spices that she used, which was ginger, black pepper, and green cardamom.
Okay. Well, right on. Well, let's get to how you make masala chai. And obviously there are millions of different ways to make it. How do you make it? How do you make a good cup of masala chai? If I wanted to go away from this right now and make a cup for myself, which I do, what should I do?
Well, so it all starts with the spices. And there are so many different spices you can use. I've noticed that a lot of people, they get nostalgic and they like to make the blends that their family made. Mm-hmm. But I've also seen people, like within my own family, there's factions who, you know, my Rajni Kaki likes to put cinnamon in her chai. And my Lila Kaki likes to put mint into the chai. And that's the original ginger, green cardamom, and black pepper.
In addition to ginger, cardamom, green pepper.
Yeah, exactly. But you can use clove, you can use cinnamon, fennel, black cardamom, rose, mint, lemongrass, tulsi, which is holy basil, ajwan, or carom seeds, star anise, nutmeg, saffron. Any of those things can be used.
Okay.
And so the base of most masala chais I've had has ginger, but it doesn't have to have ginger. That's like an important thing. And then there's what kind of ginger. Do you use dried or do you use fresh? And they create two completely different cups. The dried ginger is a little more spicy and more of a one-note ginger, mm-hmm. whereas the fresh ginger has citrus notes and lemongrass notes. It's just a whole different experience. So those are like where I would start with the spices, right?
Okay.
Then you got to figure out how are you going to treat the spices? And so there's two main ways that I've seen people treat their spices. First is to make a masala, a ground masala, and make enough for, you know, like 20 cups of tea. And that's actually how I originally started. Modiben used to do that in her older age just because it was easier, you know, take a little scoop from a jar, put it in the teapot. And I did find that for my own personal preference, that leaves kind of like a gritty last few sips with all of those spices in the bottom. Even if you use a tea strainer, you can't strain them all out. And so in my research for this article, I discovered that if you lightly crush in a mortar and pestle the spices, even just a little bit, that helps release a lot of their essential oils. And if you think about the masala, you blend it up, those essential oils are evaporating from that moment that you blend it. And so if you use it at the beginning of the month versus the end of the month, it's not going to have as much flavor at the end of the month.
Okay.
And so that's why I now use, I crush my spices in a mortar and pestle.
Yeah.
Right. And
that still isn't big enough to strain out.
Right. Exactly. Well, and some of them are, but it's not never, I just don't get a gritty sip. So the one caveat to that is I use ground ginger, because if you've ever gotten a piece of dried whole ginger, it so much effort to get that into a powder form.
So
I use the ground ginger, and I use about a quarter teaspoon of that. And then I will take a quarter teaspoon of whole black peppercorn, and I'll crush those. And black peppercorns are kind of like garlic. Like the more you crush them, the spicier they are. Mm-hmm. And so I will fully grind them. I want all of that heat. I want all of that punch. But as if you just wanted to even barely crack them, that's enough to get those essential oils flowing.
Okay.
And then I take cardamom. And the cardamom amount, it really depends on the type of spice you're using or the brand of spice you're using. If you're using a typical green cardamom from an Indian grocery store, I'm a huge cardamom fan, so this is not going to be for everyone, but I like around 7 or 8 pods of cardamom.
Oh, wow, that's a lot, yeah.
it's a lot. Hardcore. It's a lot, but this is my nostalgic flavor, right?
Sure. Yeah.
But if you're using my favorite spice brand to use is Diaspora Co., which are these organic, sustainable spices. They pay a living wage to all of their farmers. And their cardamom is like 5 times stronger than any of the cardamom in the Indian grocery stores. So I'll only use 5 pods if I'm using Diaspora.
Okay.
And then with the cardamom, again, how much you crush it changes the flavor. If you leave it whole or just barely crushed, you'll get more of a floral flavor. But mm-hmm. if you grind it more, you'll get some of the menthol flavors and some citrus flavors. So I kind of cool. do something in between. I leave some of the seeds a little whole and slightly crushed and a good chunk of them ground. And I also leave the little husks they come in because that all has flavor and you're going to strain it out at the end.
Cool.
Right? So I add that all to my pot with water. And then this brings us to like the ratio. So chai, masala chai is made with milk and water.
Yeah.
Right? And lots of people use different ratios. The most common one I've seen and the one I use is kind of 1-to-1. So equal parts milk and water. And so I start with 3/4 a cup of water. I put it in my pot. And I have a 1-quart pot. It's perfect for 1 cup of chai. And so I put that in there. I put the spices in there. And then there's a couple different methods on how to brew the spices and the tea. Some people will just put everything in, the water, the milk, the spices, the tea, all at once. And some people will do the water with the spices and tea, and then they'll add the milk. That's kind of what I prefer. And so I believe that kind of water bath with the spices really rehydrates them and kind of makes like a spice brew that you add tea to. So I'll put it in there. I'll turn it on maybe medium high. I'll let it come to a boil. As soon as it comes to a boil, I add my tea and the tea that I use. So if you want to be traditional, you will use CTC tea, crushed hair curl tea. Mm-hmm. And you can find this in any Indian grocery store. My Moti Ben grew up using red label tea. That was one of hers. I prefer to use the Chai Box's True Blend, which is a blend of crushed hair curl, Assam, and a little bit of orange pekoe and Darjeeling, just a little bit. And the amount of tea you use, again, it's personal, right? The typical amount is like 1.5 teaspoons. Oh, wow. I am really, really sensitive to caffeine. And so I use a 1/2 teaspoon of tea. And okay. So you add
pretty much any amount will do, like just to your own
preference. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The spices and water are boiling. I add the tea in and I let that boil for around like 4 minutes. And then I add the milk in. And you can use any kind of milk. You can use cow's milk. You can use soy milk, oat milk, hemp protein milk. Like any of that stuff works. I've tested the recipe with all of it. I find that whole milk really, the fat in it really like captures those essential oils from the spices and makes them sing more than using like a 2% or a 1%.
Sure.
And so you add the milk. And once you add the milk, I keep it on medium high until it comes to that first boil. And now chai is notorious for boiling over the pot. If you don't boil your chai over the pot, you haven't made chai enough. Okay. And it's literally like, 1 second it's not boiling at all. You turn your back and then it's all over the
That's when it does it too. It actually, it waits for that. Yeah.
It really does. It like taunts you. It taunts you. And so as soon as it comes to that boil, and I let the boil get to the very top of the pot, I turn the temperature completely down to low. And that I wait till all the foam subsides. And then I turn it back up, but only to medium. Because if you're using dairy milk especially, it can't handle that medium high heat. It will just constantly keep overflowing.
Yeah.
So I keep it on medium. And some people prefer to just let it come to a boil once and then simmer it a little bit and they're done. The owner of the chai box in Atlanta, Monica Sunny, she believes in the double boil, where she lets it come to a boil twice. And she says that makes it more like creamy and rich and velvety. The method that I use is mine comes to a boil like 4, 5, 6 times. Literally.
You just keep turning away. You deal with your kids. Yeah. It boils over.
Exactly. But I'm constantly like turning it down, waiting for the foam to subside, turning it up. Sometimes I'll have my head in the fridge and one of my 7-year-old will be like, "Mommy, the chai." And I'll have to run over to the stovetop and turn it down. I really like that, the flavor that the multiple boils give. And if you think about it, it's kind of mixing everything up as it comes up and then goes back down again.
Yeah, yeah.
And so the amount of time you want to simmer it, totally up to you. I think it's going to be different based on everyone's stovetop. I do mine for around 6 minutes and 30 seconds, anywhere between like 5 to 7 minutes. What I'm looking for is when it's done, it equals 8 ounces.
Okay.
And so like the first couple times I made it, I will like strain it using a little like a cup tea strainer into a liquid measuring cup just to make sure I get that right evaporation, because that's the flavor that I like.
Yeah.
And then the last thing is, do you use sugar or not? Some people don't like sugar. I am a proponent of even a tiny bit of sugar. It really accentuates those spices. It really helps you taste it. I have a sweet tooth, so I use a tablespoon of sugar. Okay. You don't have to, but that's what I do. And so that's how I make my chai.
Well, Lena, thank you so much. I can't wait to go make another cup of chai.
Thank you so much, Francis.
Lena Trivedi-Grenier is a food and culture writer based in the San Francisco Bay Area, and you can read a terrific story she wrote about the history of masala chai and how important it is in her family at Epicurious. And on our website, splendidtable.org, you can find her recipe for fresh ginger masala tea. Well, that is our show this week. Hey, take time for a nice cup of tea today. We'll talk to you next week. APM Studios are run by Chandra Kavati and Joanne Griffith. Beth Perlman's our executive producer, and The Splendid Table was created by Sally Swift and Lynn Rosetta Casper. It's made every week by technical producer Jennifer Lukey, producer Erica Romero, digital producer James Napoli, and managing producer Sally Swift. Special thanks this week to Gary O'Keefe at Marketplace's New York Bureau. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your downloads, and be sure to leave us a review. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM Studios.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.